Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we will be talking with Clinical Assistant Professor for the UNC School of Social Work's Family and Children's Resource Program, Jody Flick, about suicides. An important topic.
It is, and this is a hard topic, Christy. I think too many families across the country have some experience with this, and it's something that we frequently may not be comfortable talking about. So we're going to facilitate a conversation that won't be easy for us either, and we look forward to talking with Professor Flick. But first, we've also got some important research that matters today about diet drinks.
About robot-assisted hysterectomies.
About diabetes and high glycemic foods.
And about perhaps overprescribing of ADHD medications for healthy kids.
Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Let's dive right in there with diet drinks. You know, Christy, how did you feel? I think we talked about the ban on sodas in New York, but we haven't talked about that it got overturned by the courts or delayed, and this has to do with the diet drinks. What did you think about that?
Well, I'm all for reducing the high sugar drinks, particularly for our children in schools, and to try to cut back on that as a nation, because it's part of our obesity problem. But this is about diet drinks, and
right,
there's been some research and some scares and worries that somehow they promote people to eat more, or they promote the sweet tooth, so people might eat more sugar because they drink the diet drinks. And as a diet drinker, I am curious about this research.
Well, this was actually done at the University of North Carolina and published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. And they looked at 318 overweight or obese adults here in North Carolina, all of whom consumed almost 300 calories worth of drinks every day.
And they got one group to switch from their sugar beverages to water, and about a third to substitute them with diet drinks like Diet Coke, Diet Mountain Dew, Diet Limited Tea. Followed them for 6 months.
And what they found is that the diet drinks did not seem to lead to increase in total calories. So it was probably effective.
It's true. Both groups lost weight, whether you drank water or diet drinks. And 6 months in, the only real differences were that people in the water group ate more fruit and vegetables, and people in the randomized in the group to diet beverages ate fewer desserts. So overall, both were better choices than where they were before.
So there may be some evidence here that one can safely switch to diet drinks, and that one way to cut your calories, which gets me back to the New York case, Chris. You know I'm coming back there.
Come on back, Adam.
Come on back. Which is, well, could the folks in New York have 32 ounces of the diet drinks? Would that have been okay?
Well, it would have been okay with me.
The big gulp of diet drinks may not be hazardous to their health.
And certainly, there's lots of evidence showing that all these sugary drinks,
yes,
are hazardous to our health and our weight.
Just kind of complicates that picture, muddies it a little bit to me, but in good ways in some respects, because I think if people are drinking diet drinks and there is some health benefits, that's a good thing.
I think the bottom line is to try to cut down on those sugary drinks to reduce your calories. Let's talk about hysterectomies, totally shifting gears.
But cutting down potentially on things that you may not need, which here in this case would be whether you get those robot-assisted hysterectomies. Is that really indicated or necessary?
So lots of women have their uteruses removed, which is what a hysterectomy is. 600,000 hysterectomies are performed each year in our country.
That's a lot.
I know. And apparently, the number of robot-assisted surgeries increased from 1 in 200 back in just in 2007 to almost 1 in 10 in 2010, a rapid increase in the number of these surgeries being done in this robotic technique.
Yeah, that's really quite amazing, almost a tenfold increase in just a few years. And these researchers, in their article published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, from these researchers in Columbia University, looked at over 260,000 women who had had hysterectomies between 2007 and 2010 and tried to distinguish whether there was an improvement in outcomes from the women who had had this robot-assisted hysterectomy from the standard, which is what's called laparoscopic without the robot-assisted. And was there any difference in the two types of procedures?
Well, the bottom line is that there were the same number of complications, which were both low, for bladder injuries and bleeding, and that there was a huge difference in cost between the two, with the robotic surgery being significantly more expensive, and possibly a slightly shorter hospital stay for those who had the robot-assisted surgeries.
But 20 to 25%, not necessarily a huge clinical difference there.
And, no.
And I guess the bottom line here is there's this dramatic growth in a more expensive procedure for which the outcomes for most women show no difference. And so the question really becomes, should insurance companies pay for it? Should women automatically expect to receive this? And should our training programs emphasize doing this procedure? Over a different procedure.
And
I don't
know. I mean, this gets back to what we're talking about, technology. We think it's so good. And saying robot just sounds like that's going to be better. But in fact, there are no changes in complications or in outcomes. So I think we need to take a harder look at this.
Certainly, if your doctor suggests that you not have a robot-assisted hysterectomy and do the traditional, we call it traditional now, but it wasn't so traditional 20 years ago, but the laparoscopic hysterectomy, that's an okay thing to do, certainly. Let's talk, Christy, about our next research that matters, about does it matter if you eat foods that are low glycemic versus high glycemic? And maybe we can even define what that is, because it's been a while since we talked about this on the show.
So this is looking at these foods that have lots and lots of sugar in them in their ratio. So white bread, potatoes, and we've known that there's some link between eating a lot of those foods and diabetes.
And the foods not only have these high processed things in them, simple sugars, but they also have low fiber in them, which contributes to them having what we would call a high glycemic index. They rapidly raise your blood sugar, and this rapid raising cause you to have more risk of diabetes? And the short answer is probably so.
Yep. The people who eat a lot of low fiber and processed foods, I mean, they looked at 125,000 adult diets. The people who ate those foods that quickly spiked the blood sugars had a much higher risk of that most common form of diabetes, the type 2 kind.
And this article published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition really suggests that we should be really emphasizing the eating of more low glycemic foods, including fish, lean meats, high fiber fruits and vegetables, and some dairy products, along with brown rice and unrefined grains, rather than the high glycemic foods.
I mean, it's another study showing fruits and vegetables are very good to have in your diet and trying to reduce those high sugary foods.
That'll conclude our research that matters. We've had a time to talk about maybe reducing medications for some conditions that we can treat with non-medications, including some of the behavioral issues.
Talking about diet drinks may not fuel your appetite. They might be a safe alternative, certainly to sugar drinks.
About really reducing potentially robot-assisted hysterectomies if there's not good data that they improve outcomes.
And about high glycemic foods, again, being tied to diabetes risk. That will conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Jody Flick from the UNC School of Social Work about suicides. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with Clinical Assistant Professor for UNC School of Social Work's Family and Children's Resource Program, Jody Flick, about suicides. Welcome to Your Health, Jody.
Thank you for having me.
You know, Jody, this topic is one that's, I think, a hard topic. It's hard to think about doing this show, but yet Christy and I felt this was such an important issue that we couldn't believe we really hadn't tackled substantively in the number of years we've been on the air. So Thank you for coming and being willing to help us think through for our listeners some aspects about suicides.
Well, you're welcome. I agree with you. It is hard for most people to even think that someone would do this. And so I appreciate you're doing this.
Well, we certainly imagine it's hard work for you, dedicating your career to something so emotionally charged with such devastating consequences. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came on this path.
Well, I am a licensed clinical social worker, and I've been in clinical practice for over 30 years. And most of my direct practice has been with people in crisis situations, whether that's been in psychiatry or with the police department, but I've always been in crisis intervention services. So this has always been suicide prevention's always been an interest of mine, a professional interest of mine, and I have lost many clients to suicide over the past 30 years. And I think, as you guys probably know, if you've been in this field long enough, it's an occupational hazard. You eventually will lose clients. And about 15 years ago, I also lost my father-in-law to suicide. And that sort of put me on this collision path between my personal life and my professional life to do more to try and reduce the stigma around people getting mental health services when they need them.
So we talk about stigma and you know, sharing, there's a stigma of, I guess, why does suicide have such a stigma? I mean, I can imagine that maybe there's shame or shock and, this has been around since the dawn of civilization. This isn't necessarily new, and it's something that we all would share because we know I have family members. I remember growing up, my mother would tell me about a great aunt who one day, probably in her 80s, in some urban city, in front of all the family, just walked out the window, and we heard stories like this growing up, and so this we a lot of us share these kinds of stories.
Well, I think part of it is depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, substance abuse, the illnesses that predispose people to suicide. All of those carry that stigma of something that most people in the general public think, you know, is a personal weakness, something you could do something about if you just tried hard enough, and don't really understand those as brain illnesses, and that the symptoms of those illnesses, like feeling suicidal and despairing, is a common symptom of those brain illnesses. And so I think there's still a lot of stigma around psychiatry and going to ask for help around any of the, you know, what people used to call mental illnesses, but now I think rightly people are more calling brain illnesses because that more accurately reflects what they really are.
When you think about how common those things are, I mean, you named depression, bipolar, schizophrenia, I mean, we have so many patients in our primary care practice with depression and these illnesses, and yet, you know, we really need to educate ourselves as providers, as family members, as loved ones on how to know the difference in someone who's a little down and maybe needs some help, some medication, some counseling, versus someone who is really about to do something that's not reversible. What are those warning signs or things that we should be aware of that distinguish the common from people who are really suicidal?
Well, I think suicidal thoughts are really common in depression. And when you layer on additional things like, for example, when you add on that the person's depressed and they're drinking or drugging on top of that, or you add on that they have insomnia on top of that, or anxiety in addition to that. So the more of those other factors you have, the higher the risk is. Excessive use of substances, you know, alcohol and drugs are disinhibiting substances, and they make you act on your impulses that you wouldn't act on otherwise.
And what about stress and critical things that happen in your life, like financial problem or some big crisis? Should people be more aware in those times?
Oh, well, suicide is never, ever the result of just one single event or one single cause. That may be the losing your job or getting divorced. Those things might be the trigger event, but they're never, ever the cause. So if you think about the analogy that I use all the time is the analogy of a slot machine. So, you know, if you pull a slot machine handle and you get only one bell or one cherry, you are not a winner, right? You have to get at least three.
That's my experience, yes.
Yes. You have to get at least three or five or seven, right, to be a winner. Well, if you think of that same analogy with suicide, any one thing that happens to you, lots of people get depression and don't kill themselves. Lots of people lose their jobs and don't kill themselves. But when you take one of those illnesses and then you layer on, was this person a victim of childhood trauma, child abuse, at a young age? Are they abusing substances on top of that? Do they have access to a lethal weapon? Right. The more risk factors you layer on, Then losing the job might be the last straw, but it wasn't. It's not the basis of the suicide.
Well, you know, two things struck me as I was looking at some statistics, and to be transparent and honest, one of my interest in doing this was when I saw about some suicides in the last year of college students, and then I started reading and realizing that suicide is really one of the top first or second risk factors for death among college students. And it just blew my mind. And then I read among older men, that's the highest rate of suicides for men. And I started thinking, wow, I'm not sure I would have thought like that. So is this common knowledge? And how do we translate that knowledge into effective suicide prevention?
No, it's really not common knowledge. I think most people think about teenagers and suicide because teenagers get the most press. But in reality, the risk of suicide goes up the older that you are, as the highest risk being among elderly men in their 70s and 80s, particularly elderly white men in their 70s and 80s. So the other thing that's not common knowledge is that if you look at the statistics on murder versus suicide, the rates of suicide in the United States are almost double the rates of murder. But most people don't know that because we report murders in the newspaper and talk about them on TV in the newspaper, but we don't talk about suicide individually that way because we know that it increases suicide among the area where that is reported.
We do need to take a short break, but we'll come back and talk about that with our fantastic guest, Jody Flick, as we continue our conversation about suicides. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Clinical Assistant Professor for UNC School of Social Work, Family and Children's Resource Program, Jody Flick, about suicides, a very difficult but important conversation. And before the break, we were talking about the high risk, in particular, older adults have and older men have in terms of suicide. And wonder what, knowing that, follow-up of Adam's question, what can we do as communities to approach or open up a dialogue or support people in their older life to prevent suicides?
Well, I think one of the most important things for people is reducing social isolation, mm-hmm. increasing social connectedness. Mm-hmm. So the more that we can reach out to and develop relationships with each other so that we can take care of each other and be supportive.
And so I think this gets us into, you know, building community, and there clearly has to be a role of is faith and spirituality. Mm-hmm. Are these all ways? I mean, we tackle this with our churches and our synagogues and our mosques. Mm-hmm. What about in different populations at different phases of people's lives? How do we continue to be aware and build community? Because I know you do a lot of work in survivorship. That's another mm-hmm. community.
Well, I'm glad you brought it up, because religious affiliation is actually one of the most powerful protective factors for people. And it's very clear from the literature that it doesn't matter what religion it is. Hmm. What matters is that you believe that your life has meaning in the universe and that you're important. And that is, so talking to people about what they believe is a really, as a physician or as a neighbor, is a really good place to start. So it does serve as a very powerful protective factor for people.
And what about, I mean, if there are 30,000+ suicides a year, mm-hmm. and so over 10 years we have 300,000, we have millions and millions of Americans affected by this. Let's mm-hmm. talk about this notion of survivorship. What does it really mean when we talk about survivorship and suicides?
So we call people who have lost a loved one to suicide survivors, or survivors of suicide loss. Mm. And you know that people don't know what to say when people die of any kind of tragic death, mm-hmm. but when you have lost a family member to suicide, people really don't know what to say to you. Mm. And so one of the things that we found is most helpful is to have a group where people can get together with other people who are in the exact same situation and help each other to get through that period of time.
So community support groups where, and I would imagine, and you can tell us, that people, family members and survivors are experiencing some guilt, wishing they had recognized it. Mm-hmm. What are the kinds of things that are very common for families to go through?
Guilt is a huge one. What did I do? What did I not do? What did I miss? Interesting. Anger is really common. Mm. Sometimes anger because you're angry at the person who did this, but you're also angry because of the mess they've now left for you. Financial problems, situational problems, legal problems, all kinds of things that now you're stuck having to deal with after the fact. Another really common one that doesn't come up in the general public very much, that people don't talk about out in public very much, but in our group we talk about a fair amount, is relief. Hmm. If you're someone who has been the caretaker for a person with a chronic severe illness, and you've been taking that person to doctor's appointments and buying them medicine and laying awake at night agonizing whether they're going to come home or kill someone else on the road in a car accident, or right, those, and that person has died, there is a part of you that says, I would never, ever have chosen for this to be the way it happened, but at least it's over.
Well, and then there's probably guilt that you feel relief.
And then immediately guilt after for feeling relieved, of course.
We all know someone. We're only one stone's throw away from knowing someone who's lost someone due to suicide. What do we say? I mean, we can, as professionals, Christy and I can refer patients and talk about this work that you're doing in these survivorship of suicide loss groups. But what do we say? How do we be supportive of our friends and those who, and as a community? What do we do?
The more that we can start to see these deaths as a consequence of the illness that this person had. You know, just like people who have heart disease or cancer, sometimes people still die of those illnesses even if they get the very best treatment that's available. Well, in psychiatry, bipolar disorder and depression are psychiatry's cancer. People still die of these disorders. And the more that we can start to see these as medical disorders, and that this person's death was a symptom of the illness that they had.
So for the family members, just like we would go visit after you lost your parent or your child due to cancer, just going over there and visiting and allowing that person to talk and just being there with them. They're not alone.
Exactly. And that you treat this person's death no differently than you would treat any other death.
And tell us more, the community support groups that we can refer people to, are these for any family member or anyone who's survived someone close that's committed suicide? And how do our listeners find out more information?
Yes, absolutely. The Chapel Hill support group meets twice a month on the second and fourth Thursdays of every month in the building of the United Church of Chapel Hill at 7 o'clock. And if you are looking for that, you can find us at the Triangle Coalition for Suicide Prevention at their website or at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention website. And either of those list all the support groups locally and the times and places where they meet.
And they would list support groups potentially outside of our local area.
Yes,
we have many listeners.
For the whole state.
Okay.
And what happens if a listener finds themselves having suicidal thoughts and or you're talking with someone and all of a sudden you maybe sense that there's some distress there? What advice do you give us and our listeners? Because it seems like there is a window of opportunity to intervene. And if you're having these thoughts, those are real.
They are real. And for most people, they're very scary. And so stay with that person. If you're a friend of theirs, stay with that person until you can get them to help, to someone who can talk to them. If you're a person who's having problems with that, please go and talk to a mental health professional. Get help, because there is very effective treatment for depression and bipolar disorder, the two illnesses that most predispose people to suicide. Both treatments in terms of medicine and also treatments in terms of specific types of therapy that are very effective.
Well, there are crisis lines. There's a crisis clinic at UNC. Do most hospitals and most areas have certain crisis numbers for this kind of thing? And how do people find that?
There's also a 1-800, the 1-800 Suicide National Crisis Hotline. So that's also available. Most hospitals, all local mental health centers, the police department, all of those have crisis intervention specialists that can talk to someone if you're in trouble.
We've been talking with Jody Flick from UNC School of Social Work about suicides. And Jody, thank you so much for coming on Your Health. This is an important, important conversation. I really can't thank you enough for sharing your time and expertise and compassion with our listeners across the Triangle and beyond. Thank you.
It's been an honor to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Jody.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we get to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
And Christy, if any of our listeners want to send us some questions, they can send them to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we have questions today about drinking and what's called DTs.
About taking a lot of medicines for chronic medical problems.
About glucosamine as a supplement and possible side effects.
And about tinnitus or tinnitus and something called lipoflavonoids.
Well, we better dive right in. These are some great questions. Let's listen to our very first house call.
I've heard that people who drink too much and stop suddenly can get DTs. Is this really serious? And if so, how should people stop drinking?
DTs. Those are not grades that you get in school, but delirium tremens, which is a fancy term for a really bad withdrawal from alcohol.
It's true. Some people who withdraw from alcohol get really anxious and shaky, but it can progress to, for about 5% of people who withdraw from alcohol, get confused, have a rapid heartbeat, crazy blood pressures, fever, this thing called DTs, and a lot of people die from it.
Yeah, 100 years ago, the mortality from this was over 30%, and it is down a lot now, but people can still get really serious heart abnormalities and arrhythmias. And so if you're at really risk for DTs, which is if you're a heavy drinker and if you've had it in the past when you quit drinking, you really do need to be hospitalized and be on really supportive, watchful care and even IV medication to help prevent this from occurring.
There are medicines that can help reduce the withdrawal symptoms and that can help keep you safe and protect you from DTs. But if you are a daily drinker and it's time to come off the alcohol, we want to encourage you to do that. It's time to do it now. We want you to talk to your doctor about it and be forthcoming about truly how much you're drinking so that you and your doctor can come up with a safe plan, either inpatient or outpatient.
Sounds good to me.
All right, let's take our next one.
I'm on 15 medications for all kinds of medical problems, like heart failure, diabetes, high blood pressure, and ulcers. I worry, though, that I am still on way too many medicines. How do I best cut down on the number of medicines I take?
Wow, you're on a lot of medications. And when the first sounds of it, Christy and I probably would both say, this is too many. But it's hard sometimes to really know that because you've got a lot of health problems, too.
Yeah, and when I look at your list of medical problems with heart failure and diabetes and high blood pressure and ulcers, those things I can just think off the top of my head, the various medications that are proven to benefit you with those particular problems. So it's not that surprising that it's gotten up to 15, but I do think you're doing right by being concerned about this and wanting to make sure that you're not taking extra medicines you don't need. So I'd advise you, and I'm sure, Adam, you'd agree that it's worth a special visit to your doctor. And if your doctor can pair up with a pharmacist in the practice to really look through those medicines and make sure that they are all important and that you're clear on which ones are optional.
Yeah, and Christy and I won't be able to tell you, but I think if you say what one of your goals is, then your goal is to get down on the number of medicines because you're risking all kinds of side effects mm-hmm. here and drug interactions that I'm not even sure they've been written about yet when you combine 15 different medications. But, you know, there are medicines that can treat hypertension and heart failure. The same medicine can be treating both. And are you on the maximum dose of one medicine before you go to 2 and 3 medicines to treat the same condition? Because if you're on 3 or 4 medicines for each of these conditions, we would probably say that might be too much. But yeah. only your doctor and you can really determine.
A lot of questions that this raises, but you're doing right by being concerned about it. And I would say keep taking your medicines, but go in and talk with your doctor about which ones you might be able to
cut out. I've got a rule, Christy. You know what my rule is?
What's that?
I say sometimes with some patients, if we add any new medicine, we got to take 2 of them away.
Well, that's nice, especially now that we have combination pills. Where
oh, that I'm sure that counts. If I give you a combination pill, does that count as 1 or 2 medicines?
I don't know. I count it as 1. Okay, let's go to our very next house call question.
I had a bleeding ulcer recently, and my doctor said to stop my daily aspirin. He also asked me about glucosamine, and I was taking it, but he said to stop that too, as it could cause bleeding. I was surprised, and I thought most supplements were safe.
You got a good doctor there, first off, who immediately kind of looked and said, okay, you're on something that could be causing this bleeding, like a baby aspirin or a daily aspirin, and go on and stop it if you've been having a bleeding ulcer. That's right up the right track.
And I also think this highlights how important it is to always tell your doctor, even if he or she doesn't ask you, always tell your doctor about the herbal medicines, supplemental medicines that you might be taking, because they do have side effects and interactions with other medicines.
Yeah, in addition to things like fish oil and vitamin E that people take and have taken that can thin out the blood, glucosamine, even though people think of it as safe, it does cause stomach upset and heartburn and gas and bloating. And so if you've got an ulcer, you know, and it can thin out the blood and interact with Coumadin, and which is another blood thinner, and interact with these things like Advil. So all of this class of medicines, including the glucosamine, should be stopped. We would actually agree with your doctor here, and hopefully you won't have any more of this bleeding ulcers.
Let's take our last house call.
I saw a commercial on TV for something called lipoflavonoid, which they said can cure ringing in the ears. Can you tell me if this is a good treatment for tinnitus?
Lipoflavonoids. Christy, are you an expert in lipoflavonoids?
I cannot say I'm an expert, but I did look it up and found out it is an over-the-counter supplement, and it's mostly vitamins and extracts from different bioflavonoids. So vitamin B6 and 12, vitamin C, niacin, a lot of vitamins that you would find in your daily multivitamin. And there's a lot of marketing around it and helping for tinnitus or tinnitus. What do you say?
I say tinnitus. You say?
Tinnitus.
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 You say, okay. No, we won't go there. But ringing in the ears, which is really this chronic problem. And right now, if anyone says that they can really cure it for a lot of people who've had it for a long time, be a little bit suspicious, because if there really were this type of treatment out here, we'd all be using it, and we're all looking for this treatment. Our medicines aren't great. They can help a little bit.
I also think if you're having ringing in your ears, make sure that you go to your doctor, and then if it hasn't gotten better, that you go back just to see if there's an underlying reason. It could be as simple as earwax that needs to come out, or it could be a blood vessel condition or medications like aspirin.
It could be a side effect of some medicines like aspirin. That's exactly right.
And there might be some things that could help make it better. So I'm not recommending these over-the-counter supplements, the lipoflavonoids, at this point, but we need to keep looking.
Right, because we want everyone out there to feel better, and we thank you for sending your questions to us. And if you have any questions you want to send them to yourhealth@unc.edu. You can also send them to us at yourhealthradio.org, or send it to us through our Facebook site, or even through Twitter.
We want to thank the staff, WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Jody Flick. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
We'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.
Need your local culture fix? The lifestyle section of chapelboro.com is the only place to go for food and dining, restaurant views, health tips, fashion, and local culture commentary. Want to know what the best shows and venues to attend? Lifestyle has show listings for Deepak, Cat's Cradle, and the Art Center, and many more. And be sure to check back after the show for reviews and commentary. There's even information on local neighborhoods and schools. Keep yourself in style with Chapelboro's Lifestyle.